Good morning. Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. Boy, we are hearty souls. Anyone who was on the highway today, anyone who was on Lakeshore Drive, understands the difficulty with the traffic and the accidents and blah, blah, blah. But nonetheless, we're really thrilled you're here. I'm Shirley Ryan. I want to draw your attention to the fact that Northwestern is celebrating its 150th year of having women at Northwestern. And so you say to yourself, how old is Northwestern University? I think it's 11 to 13 years older than that, which is quite an amazing achievement when you think about that. And those of us who went to Northwestern, as I think several of you did, took it for granted that it was a co-ed education, and you chose it for that reason. It did empower me. It did allow me to see the world through those eyes. And so that's ironic that it's in the same time when the United States has not been ever talking more about the importance, the intelligence, and the contribution of women. The women that are here today, your first speaker will be extraordinary, and you'll see why. But I thank each of you for being here. I want you to remember that there is no class next week, and we're doing that in observation of holidays. And we thank you for being here. You will be reminded of that. We've had a really great class. Thank you. And now to our Rachel. There's only one Rachel Mercy who sent out to us immediately, like nearly the same day, probably so, and the entire synopsis of our class, the New York Times editorial referenced, and podcasts that recommended by the faculty. I think it's a great idea. Who would like to see more podcasts that people see and read on a constant basis just on our mailings in order to understand what we may find interesting to download? Anyone interested in getting podcasts? All right. Thank you. All right. Have fun.
Thank you, Shirley. Well, I appreciate, especially today, as you all came in looking so beautiful, you guys taking me as I am. I did not go on Lakeshore Drive. I walked from my apartment. So I'm looking a little bit more like the salt container girl. So I do appreciate that you guys are taking me as I am. And as I watched our first speaker walk in these beautiful shoes, I thought to myself, that's why I'm not a dean. So it is with... and that's the truth. There are probably a bunch of other reasons, too. It's really a great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. Francesca comes to us from Europe and now is finding Northwestern her home only for about a month now. And I won't repeat the bio that is on your sheet in front of you, but I will say this. I was in a meeting of researchers, associate deans for research at Northwestern, and her associate dean for research said, she has only been on the job 2 weeks, and she already knows more than I do. And I think that is a tremendous compliment from someone who has been at the institution for a long time to say Kellogg is a very complex place with tentacles into lots of different issues, and Francesca is going to talk to us about one of them today, about women in business and finance. So please join me in welcoming Francesca.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for the wonderful and warm welcoming. Actually, since I arrived, it's been a short time, but actually I've been receiving a warm welcoming from everybody, and I was looking forward to this lecture. And when I was thinking about what to talk, really, I've been thinking, okay, what do I talk about? Me as a researcher, me as a dean? So I think you're going to have a bit of a potpourri of everything in the sense I want to talk about the first part about exactly how a more institutional role is something that I hope to continue to do as a dean, which is how to promote exactly women in finance. But a second one, I also feel at heart an academic still, and I want to talk a bit about my research, which is finance and exactly implication that have and how I will talk about a couple of topics that I've touched and the implication. But so let me start, and you can see our beauty, you know, some marketing. This is our beautiful global hub at Kellogg. So let me start, first of all. So as I say, this is the promotion more of women in finance academics, and it's something that I've been involved in. Let me already start. I with other five women, actually one is also a woman in finance at Kellogg. Kellogg has actually excellent record of women in finance. John will come after me, will be another example. We're still not that many, but still we are leading, which is great. And that's why it's also perfect that now is the anniversary of 150 years women in Northwestern. So it looks like we are, you know, leading the thing. But it still needs a lot of pursuing, okay? And let me start by telling you a little bit how the career works in academics, and therefore then it will have implication why it's difficult. You have a PhD, and then you join a department of finance as an assistant professor. And then you'll have, depending, you know, it changes a bit depending on the institution and how it's done, between 7 and 9 years in which you publish as much as you can, and you try to be visible, impactful. You know, people, it's not only about how much you publish, it's how much people cite you, how much you do for all those 9 years, and then people will review, okay? And people will ask, an internal committee will ask letters from top people in your area, in any other business school, will read your papers, how impactful they are, will look where they're published, are in the top journal. So it will be a general assessment of everything you accomplished so far, and also what is the potential of being, you know, even more impactful going forward. And then the decision is up or out. That is, either you're promoted and you obtain tenure, or you have to leave. Okay, so it's really, you know, a very bimodal thing, and you can't, you know, it's a risky, you know, we do take risks. So this is what it is, right? So it's important to have publication, and important to be engaged in the field, to be seen, right? A place like Kellogg only wants someone who is seen as a leader in the field, right? And not just someone who contributed to the field. So what's the problem in a gender gap? So we've gone back and looked, and there's very few women in senior position in finance, okay? So if you take a woman and a man who start, women are less likely to get tenure, okay? Women in economics also, not only in finance, they are 20% less likely than a man to get tenure. So these are just facts with the data, okay? It's not saying why, but this is what it is. And actually, interestingly enough, the gap is even larger for women without children or single women. So we do have the hurdle of women and families, right? And but that's not that, right? It's clearly when we work harder, we try to overcome that. The issue is something else that is holding us back. Now, there's been 3 years ago, coming out, a very influential paper written by someone who's actually a PhD student, who was a job market paper from the economics department at Harvard. And what she did, she looked at the probability of getting tenure for every additional publications you have, okay? Because, as I'm saying, people will look, how much did you publish in a top journal? And that is part of how impactful you've been. And so it's clear that the more publications you have, the more likely it should be that you will obtain tenure. What she found, however, was that for a man, every single additional publication increased their chance to get tenure. For a woman, no, it depended on the quota. If it was single, the woman was the only author, or was co-authored with another woman, that was increasing the chances. If the paper was co-authored with a man, it had zero impact, on the probability to increase the getting tenure. And the message, was because probably a lot of the merit was often attributed to the men, not consciously, right? The idea is you read this paper, you think how impactful this person is, and you're trying to say, will this person be a leader? And when you have co-authored paper, fair enough, it's always a fair question to ask to what extent this person is, more the executor of who has the brilliant ideas and will continue to have the brilliant idea and who actually is the leading. But this fact that consistently it was clear that when the woman was co-authoring with a man, this is where we enter in the realm of conscious bias. Somehow, in the mind of people, it was not given enough weight. Okay, so that is a serious cause of concern. It got a lot of attentions. Another thing is, look at this. Women are rarely chosen as keynote speaker. If you take some of the most prestigious conferences, very, very few keynote speakers. Okay, and the thing is, most of the people will not notice it because, you just think, oh, this is it, it's one man after the other. And of course, they are amazing academics. Nobody would say, oh, why did you choose that? There's someone else better. Because they are all very good. But nobody's really paying attention that you don't have enough. And it's the same actually even in seminars. There's now more departments that make a conscious effort, and I'll come back to that, in having women academics. But I do remember when I first became the chair of the finance department in London that, the schedule was ready, and actually was a PhD student who came to me and she said, the entire speaker series are all men. I find it very demotivating, right? And yet, nobody was thinking about it. And that ultimately brings to that. And the keynote speaker is the same, right? You're an assistant professor and you never see a woman to be, the keynote speaker, the one to that, despite very, very prominent women in the profession. So in general, also what you can see, actually, let me show you the next slide, otherwise I won't have time, is the same message. What you see is that the percentage of women in the profession decreases as we get more senior. So you see the green is the percentage of women who are in the PhD program. It's above 30%. By the time we get people who are in a tenure track, which means people in a research, they become assistant professors and they are going through the research and eventually getting tenured, we dropped dramatically. This is the professor. So by the time we are professor, is 11%. So you can see a dramatically drop as we become more and more senior. Another thing, as I was mentioning, I showed you some very dramatic low numbers because those were very prestigious. But on average, only 8% of keynotes are women versus 20% profession, full professor or not. So again, there's a clear gap. There's also some very, very recent papers published by two very accomplished women faculty, Sherman and Tuke. So they looked at the academic finance profession. And, the idea is we have to be balanced, right? Is it, what is driving the result and what is happening? So they say, first of all, only 15.8% of finance faculty from the top U.S. business schools are women, but there's three factors. One, actually women tend to publish less. That is a fact, okay, on average, and I'll come back to that. We can speculate on what their speculation, but yes, they are less productive. However, what they show is even if you control for productivity, so even if you take two women who have published the same level of citation, so it should be equivalent to a man, they tend to be in slightly lower level business school, not as prestigious. All other things equal, they don't seem to be get tenure in the same things. They are less likely to be tenured than a man, and they are on average approximately paid 4% less. So, you know, this is, I actually find it very interesting, because in business school we go on, we promote, we're saying, you know, there shouldn't be a gap in the pay for women, but we have it ourselves, right? And the fact that faculty salaries are very, you know, they're not very public, make it easier for a woman not to know what the colleagues are paid. In general, also, and that comes, women tend to have more female co-authors. This is, I don't know why, I don't know whether it's because women prefer to work with other women, or, as I was mentioned before, they sense that if they work with a man, they're not as recognized. But as a fact, women tend to work more with other women. But you can see that actually create an issue, because as John, I'm sure, knows, you know, it's not that easy to find a co-author, someone who has the same interest in the area, who has the same style of working, someone you work with. Once you find one person, you keep very often working with that person, or, you know, the people that you really get along with. So that is also the problem, right? The smaller is the network of other women with whom we can work, the more difficult it is to find that perfect co-author, which could contribute to your publication record and what's happening. So this is a fact. Now, another thing is, I want to come, and again, as an academic, right, we always say, I can give you the fact, I cannot say exactly what is the cause of this fact, but I want to suggest one thing, and I'm sure a lot of you must have experienced the same. If you're a woman, one of the possible explanations for less productivity is that if you're a woman, you do so much more service in addition to teaching and publishing. They are the ones who tend to volunteer for committees, for additional services. Or these days, actually, even if you don't volunteer, everybody says, oh, we want diversity, we want a woman in the committee. So we take a few women and ask them to be in a committee. So on average, women seem to do much more service than men. This is another recent paper of 2017 that was showing that. Another fact also is that students tend to perceive female professor as much more nurturing, as much more helpful, which is great. That's why we want a female professor. However, what it means is the students tend to be more likely to go to talk to the female professor, to ask for their help. So the female professor tend to spend much more time with the students. This is good, this is what we want, but then if that is not recognized, it doesn't help women in their career forward, that is a problem, right? So this is other things that they're saying. So basically, the idea is, what these two papers are suggesting is, when we say women are less productive because they are publishing less, we may be underestimating the fact that actually they don't have as much time to dedicate to research because of everything else they are doing. And you can see that this is something that extends very often to beyond the academic finance. In a way, the advantage of looking at this for academics in finance is that we can measure these things. We can measure how much someone is published, how much someone is spent doing research versus things which are not research. So we can look at this and then see it as kind of the challenges that women can fit often. Okay, so, and then I'm saying the importance of network is very important and we have to do something. And that has, you know, and that in recent years it has improved, that there's more women who are entering the profession. So while, if you look at the period of 2000 and 2017, the men who were already, so the percentage of women who were already tenured was 9.5%. but the percentage of women who made tenure is 23.8%. So clearly it's getting better. It's still not hitting the best institution. They're still for the same level of productivity at a slightly lower level, but it is improving. But, you know, so it's a positive trend, but we just can't wait because there's issues, right? There's still no women being keynote. There's this, that's not enough networking. And what can we do? And this is where we created AFECT. AFECT is actually basically a committee of the American Finance Association. When we created it, it was important for us to be recognized as part of the biggest finance association of academics. So it to be not, you know, not on the side, but just in the core of the association of the professions. And we were six women, but then very, very soon a lot of people joined us. And actually, it's just like I was in London at the time, there was another woman in Australia, and then four women in the US, where, you know, the finance profession is most advanced, but also there are more women who progress. But it was important for us to be seen as international. You know, although we are part of the American Finance Association, it was more of an international movement, because again, the network is important, it's international. And I want to stress that this was the Australian one, found an artist who did this logo, and I love it. What it's supposed to mean is it's supposed to be at the same time the network and the glass ceiling, right? So it's I think it's very nice. That's what she did. And what we do is really facilitating networking, conduct research. So all these actually papers that I'm citing came out because we started collecting data and then giving them to researchers that would do, because otherwise you wouldn't have all these facts about what is happening, right? And provide mentoring. So this is all the things, and also what we have on the website. By the way, I was on the board, but you know, when I accepted to become a dean, I stepped down. But there's a, you know, we had a natural change of new women. I mean, every woman now in the finance profession, I think, is very much involved. And on the website, we have several, you know, best practices, which again are very important for everybody to think about. And if you want, they are also a message for everybody. First of all, how important is mentoring, okay? And that's where, for example, we tried to create a mentoring. Because if you're a young assistant professor and you're the only woman, then the mentoring is very difficult to have a mentoring for another woman. You could find a man that is equally mentoring, but what about the difficulty as a woman? So again, you need an association who will try to reach out for these type of things. Acknowledge unconscious bias, right? We all have this implicit bias that obliges, we make association with a woman with softer, maybe less good. No, we all, I hope, but a lot of people do. And by the way, at Kellogg now, I think Northwestern in general, everybody has to take an implicit bias test. Okay, if you've never done it, you can go on the internet and you can take it. It's very interesting because it tells you exposed, do you have an implicit bias or not? And sometimes even women do. And so it's very important to ask people to do this implicit bias test, because people get surprised. They will say, no, I don't think less of women. And then they take the test and they discover it. So this is something that the psychologists recommend. And this is something, again, just people be aware if they have some implicit less, you know, propensity towards women. Also, to be aware about seminar invitation. You know, the idea is to think when you're doing a seminar invitation, because what happens is you'll have more men, so the probability there is a man organizing it, it's more likely, which is fine. But then everybody starts thinking, okay, who are my friends? Who are the people I want to talk to? Which is natural. Very often, the organizer of a seminar is a young assistant professor, and is the chance for them to get to know the people, the senior people they want to know. But if they naturally think immediately to a man, you can see that all the men get invited and not the women. So the thing is, you have to make an effort. That's why, for example, on the website, we put all the women. I had so many time answers say, no, but I would like to invite women, but there aren't. It's like, no, you just haven't paid attention to how many accomplished women there are. And having the website saying by area, if you're interested in this area, here are all the amazing women you could invite, right? And think about it. And it's amazing because people say, oh, yes, of course there's that person. Oh, of course, she's very good. I hadn't thought of her. That's exactly what happens. And the idea is you have to be deliberate. When there's nomination to academic association offices, who would you nominate in a board? Who would you ask for a keynote? Just stop a moment and think, can I think of a, you know, very accomplished, very successful woman? We are not asking anything else, but just to think, can I think of some? And to their own surprise is when they start thinking, they do find amazing women. Other things is be careful in the language. There are some papers that show, for example, especially in finance, when you try to get a job the first time for an assistant professor, right, the supervisor, another faculty will write a letter. It is a fact, and since someone pointed it out, I now read the letters. I noticed that when I will write for a man, they will say clever, brilliant, all these things. And the woman will be charming, hardworking. It's absolutely... And again, I don't think people realize that. They are not... Until you put them in front of what they've written, that is the problem. People are not deliberately doing that. So what you need is to make people more aware of these facts and say, oh, but actually, I think the world of her. Well, then show it in the letter by thinking about what type of language you're using. Other things is, again, for example, extension on tenure clock. This is This is a big issue, actually, in most universities discussing, because if a woman has a child, now the idea is it was 7 years to publish enough. The tendency is now we give one more year because of clearly they lost 1 year. You know, in the year of the child, they couldn't be as productive as it would have been without a child. Then, however, the movement has said, well, you know, men, are we saying that men don't take care of the children? Of course they do. That is what we should at least aspire to. And therefore, nowadays, in most institutions, as forward-looking, the men can also get the extra year if they have a child. Of course, most of the women feel that is not exactly the same. But that is the debate, because I've been in that debate, and it's very difficult, because when you're trying to say as a woman, I said, so are you saying the woman is the one who should take care of the child and not the man? I said, I'm not saying that, but I'm saying there's a lot of other things that happen, and there's a pregnancy, and so you can see, you know, it's not as simple, and this is not about only women in finance. But what we show this, for example, is there's various schools who have taken different approaches and have been very thoughtful and thought about these things, and is about showing best practice. So just don't think it's an easy answer. Don't think, you know, we can fix it in an easier way. We have to be deliberate. We have to think about this type of issues. Implicit bias education, we say childcare coverage. A typical thing a woman will say struggles is when they have small children to go to conferences. Who is going to take care of my child? And they may not have full-time nannies or family close by, or they may not afford, you know, a full-time nanny. So, and actually, Northwestern is very good with that. They have some money to help pay for either the child to stay with the accommodation or childcare. Because even if you bring the child with you, then you have to go to the conference, right? So so the idea is, can you, you know, very often hotels pay, and the university will provide some money to cover for childcare. Because again, that's what brings, remember, you want to be seen as accomplished and people think of you. If you never go to conferences, that's also the thing about, you know, a woman and a man co-author. The paper is brilliant, but all you've seen in various conferences, the paper is the man presenting the paper, discussing it, being very accomplished and very good at answering questions and saying how meaningful it was. In your mind, it will remain the fact that the man was leading, right? Because you've never seen the woman presenting it. So again, it's very important that the women do not say, well, I have children for these 3 years, I'm just not going to go to conferences. It's okay, I'm going to keep my time for producing. Unfortunately, it's not as simple as that. What you lose is the recognition of being impactful by a leader and not just having a publisher. And as I mentioned, really recommending implicit bias education. And I'm proud to say Kellogg and Northwestern, and I can say also Kellogg because I just arrived, so I cannot take any of the merit, but they're really leading in a lot of these things. So this is, you know, one of the things, you know, that I actually am committed to do more and more at Kellogg. But I also, as I'm saying, I think it's something that we should all think in various type of profession, is just to think always about this implicit bias, or when, again, trying to get to the root, right? If a woman is not progressing, what is it? Is it they are not networking? Is it people are not using the right language? And then we can try to take action which are targeted to what is can be the root of the problem. Now I'm going to have a complete 180 degrees. That is like already I'm lost on angles, but and change on the topic. I just want to talk briefly about a bit of my research. And one that I've done is, one on which I worked a lot, is book building. Let me explain a bit what it means, okay? This is about when companies are taken public. The process is, you will have that the company will hire an investment bank as an advisor, which will be called underwriter. The company, the investment bank will look at the company, will evaluate all type of, you know, cash flows, the probability, you know, as you value a company, and will come out with a range. Actually, before book building, which now goes back 20 years, but before, will come up with a price. And then people just had to, you know, the price of this company is 10, and people just had to decide, okay, do I buy at 10 or not? And that's the process of the IPO, in which people would decide how many shares to buy for 10. The book building started 20 or more years ago and became more and more common. What it means is recognizing that, you know, does the underwriter really know that the price is a 10? And, you know, maybe not. And we saw all sorts of strange behavior. Unfortunately, we see it also now with book building. And so I will come back to the fact that it's not necessarily, you know, a panacea, but it's an improvement. So what instead will happen with the book building, the underwriter, so the investment bank, will come up with a range and will say, we think the price is between 5 and 50. Okay, so 10 is still the middle of the range, but between 5 and 15. And then, let's say in the 20 days before the company is actually listed on the stock exchange, they will accept bids, if you want, I'll specify no more, but offer from any investor. Okay, usually, if there's a retail, it's usually the, you know, individual people will be captified. These are usually institutional investors, fund managers who are buying a large amount of shares. They have an idea, because the idea is they might have an idea about what is the price. And they will say, they have a two type of way of which they will say, I want 15,000 shares, no matter what's the price. I don't know. As long as, you know, what is the price you choose, by aggregating all the bids, I'll buy 15,000 shares no matter what, at whatever price you want. And other people will say, well, I want 10,000 shares as long as the price, for example, is no larger than 11. Okay? I think more than 11 is too much. I'm not buying more than that. Okay? So it's a bit of an auction. Okay? The reason why I'm saying it's a bit of an auction is because in an auction, the rules are clearly defined. In an auction, it says whoever bids for more wins and gets most of the share, and the price is determined depending on the bids with a very well-specified rule. In this case, the underwriter has all the discretion they want. So they can look at all the shares, they look at the demand, and they say, well, at 11, I lose this demand. Above, so if I price it more than 11, someone is not buying anymore, but maybe there's still a lot of people who are buying. So you'll decide, and you might decide, okay, the price is still 10, aggregating all this information. But you can see that, first of all, the way the price is decided is decided by the underwriter on the basis of the bid, but there's no rule that says you have to do it in this way or other way, right? So it's at the discretion of the underwriter. And the other thing is how then you go back and tell the people who bid how many shares they get is at the discretion of the underwriter. What I mean is, and this is actually, a lot of these things have been shown, my research, I was the first to have all the bids, all the shares, and to really look at how it shows, all right? So besides then some insight, but just even showing how it works. But you will typically set up a price in which there's excess demand. So suppose you say, well, if I price it at 12, I'm selling 100 shares, the demand is exactly 100, you know, that's what we think, demand equals supply. Let's set it at that price. That's exactly the price I want. Well, it doesn't work that way because you think the day after, if I have the shares and I'm trying to sell them, everybody who wanted the shares already got them, I can't sell it. So the argument typically is we set at a price such that there's more demand than supply. So there's still people that after the company is listed will want to buy shares. Okay? But didn't you see that the discretion has a lot of impact? Because now I have, you know, sometimes the demand is five times as much as the shares I have to sell. I'm selling 100,000 shares, and I set a price at which there's a demand for 500,000 shares. To whom do I give these shares, right? And the answer is the underwriter decides. They might talk with the company. Depends on the company. Depends on how much expert in this process the company may be. Some small companies, you know, if you have a private equity or venture capital, they go public all the time. They will have much more control on the process. But if you have an entrepreneur, it's obviously their first time to go public. They will really listen to the advice of the bank. And therefore, they will give more to some and give less to others. Okay? And the big question, therefore, is does the discretion make sense or not? Right? Is it just exploitation or not? Now, I'll show you in a moment. What our paper showed, it was now some time ago, is that it's not as bad as it may look. Actually, the discretion is used to extract information for people, and I'll tell you in a second. So it is actually good. Since then, however, you know, there have been scandals and so on, and there's been the debate has continued, and I was brought in back in the middle of one scandal recently in London because there was the Royal Mail. They privatized the Royal Mail, and it was a bit of a total disaster in the sense that they sold at a price and didn't give much shares to individuals who wanted to buy, and then the price afterwards went through the roof. So it was a big scandal. And this is where, you know, that is the issue. The discretion, although I can show you that when it's well done, it's actually good, it's for the good. The point is, how do I control that sometimes it's not used badly, right? How, you know, that is always the problem of discretion. But let me explain what we tried to do in this case. We showed that it's really the idea, which is the idea of an auction otherwise, is that you want to set the system so as to reward people for giving you information. What I mean is the following. If someone told me, I'll buy 10,000 shares, no matter what is the price, technically, that person is willing to pay more. Because it says, if you set 15, I'll pay it. Okay? However, that person is also telling me nothing about where I should price it. Right? It's, you know, I still know as much as before. Maybe it's 5, maybe it's 15, maybe it's 10. Where do I choose? So that person is still the one technically is bidding higher, willing to pay more, but is also not giving information. While the person who's saying, I will buy shares at 11, right? That person is willing to pay only up to 11. So it's a lower bidder. But actually, it's giving me information and saying, you know, according to my information, 12 is too much. So basically, what we show is that actually the bias, the discretion, is actually so as to favor the people who are giving me the information, who are telling me I will not pay more than 11. So I actually tend to, on average, favor in the allocation the people who give me information, although the way you give information is to be, by being willing to pay less. Okay, and therefore, we do a lot of tests. We show all these as academics. But I can tell you, when we started doing it, what was interesting for us, we had a backlash of people at the beginning who were saying, this is not possible. What information do these people have? Notice, now it's natural to everybody, but at the time, it was a backlash because we were saying, the investment bank has gone there. They had all the books. They had all, you know, all the cash flows. They interviewed the manager. They know everything inside the company. How could they know less than the fund manager outside who haven't had access to that information? And I understood their point, but what we showed then in a related paper is actually the information on the book, so of these bids of people, was very useful in understanding what happened in the market afterwards. So there was indeed information from what the investors had, okay? And therefore, it really changed in a subtle, I mean, not only my paper, I don't want, you know, we were the first looking at book building, but also in general people who study fund manager, mutual manager, changing from someone who looks at the company knows everything. You know, valuation of a company is very often subjective. It depends on, do you really think there will be, the economy will be booming for the next 3 years, or there will be a recession soon. Obviously, there's a difference, and it's not clear the investment bank knows more than the investors there. Do you really think this company can export in other countries? Well, it depends also on how you view this industry, right? So there, you go from all the information is there in the books, and if I read them, I know exactly what is in it, to the view that there's a lot of information out there that investors have, and I want that information. If I want to know what's the value of some stock, if I want to know what's the value of the shares, I need to aggregate information. Which means sometimes when you see strange behaviors of the shares, like the company goes public and then the price goes up too much or goes too low, very often you can go back and look at some investors' behavior and so on and notice that there were seeds. There were some people, and of course you may disregard and thinking they are wrong and different point of view, but there's a lot more information which needs to be aggregated. Said that, as I'm saying, more recently, because of too many scandals, the push is more towards doing more like an auction. It's also because recently we do have a lot of tech companies. You know, Google started it. It was no Exalian auction. Now we had other companies like Slack doing it. When you have a tech company, you know, it's part of their image. They say, well, I don't want the investment bank looking at me, getting the bids over the phone. We are a tech company. I want to go on the internet. I'm having people bid with an internet. So the evolution from this much more relational method to a much more technical method, it depends also from the fact that the tech company can be seen in this way. Now, what's the problem with the auctions is that they don't necessarily work, because this is what I would say, I reward more one, or it was interesting because the data I had were international. So when I was talking to the investment banker, he was saying, the German will all, this was what we were talking about, for example, in one case was a European IPO. I mean, everybody, but they were, he was telling me, the German, if they want 10,000, they will tell me 10,000, and the same the English. The Italians will tell me 50,000. So I have to discount before even consider it. I was like, okay, I know, I'm Italian, I'm used to this. So I was like, yes, I know. So again, it's all these things. How do you take into account these things in an auction? So there's, you know, the debate is still out there, and this is why we still have things that work or doesn't work. The good thing of an auction is you avoid, you know, all possible not right things of an underwriter having so much discretion and not using it in the right way. We by now have a technology, we can do auction in a sophisticated way. The downside is, are we really taking into account of all the factors, or are we sometimes ignoring some of the factors that showed sometimes in these cases recently some actually abnormal behavior? And because I'm getting away, I'm running out of time. Let me tell you one more. As I'm saying, sorry, I'm overwhelming with you all this information, but this is my chance. I'm seeing you for the first time, and you know, and I'll tell you a lot of things. One other big area of research in which I worked is private equity. Let me tell you in advance, I always say I'm not interested necessarily in private equity per se, but I'm interested in private equity more as a lab. Can we learn from private equity how a general company can do, right? You know, they may do things, some things right, they may do some things wrong, but some part of the success, can we learn it about in general? And one of the part is about actually the corporate governance. And let me explain in a short amount of time a bit the message. Normally, when we talk of boards of public company, right? So company listed, typical public board of companies, what the corporate governance literature has done, and you will often see it in the media, is we look at how fast they are very often in replacing a CEO who is not performing as a good sign, okay? That is, oh, look at that board. The company is underperforming. They are not replacing. This is a bad sign. They might be entrenched. They are friend of the CEOs. So the general assessment that you see also in the academic literature is you look at how active they are in taking action is a sense that they are good board, they are active, okay? But there's been recently some papers, and this is not mine, so I will come on the private equity angle, but some papers have shown that actually some public boards replace CEOs for the wrong reason. They're saying the CEOs are replaced for bad luck. In the following sense, if you're underperform, but it's an industry shock. So what they can show is sometimes a company is underperforming, the entire industry is underperforming, okay? But if as a member of the board you feel the pressure, I have to take an action. I have to take an action because everybody's looking at me. And you know, if people say, well, the company is underperforming, the board is not to take an action, I'll be seen as entrenched. So people will, so there's been some evidence that people say, the boards are firing the CEOs for the wrong reason, for like an industry shock, for something that is not specific to that CEO. There is no reason to replace that CEO, okay? And what we went to look at the private equity. What was interesting is, if you ask anybody, they will say, well, the private equity are more effective because if they want to replace a CEO, they own 100% of the company, they'll do like this and they will replace it, right? It's very easy. That is the normal thing. People think the private equity is faster in replacing the CEO, the CFO, the management team. So we went to look, not when the private equity buys the company, they might replace the CEO, that's fine. But once they have a CEO in place, and we look at during the time in which the private equity has bought this company and owns 100%, do they fire often the CEO? And what we find is that they fire the CEO much less often than the public companies. The CEO turnover of a private equity company is lower than the CEO turnover of public companies and less dependent on performance, absolute performance, that could be due to the industry. And we show with various tests, and also we have different, I've written more than one paper in these areas and different data, that is because exactly they are being much more involved, right? Because if on the board of a private equity company, you will have the partners of the private equity. So they will obviously, it's their job, they will spend much more time. They will have people who will collect information for them. In the public, if you're a member of a board of a public company, you have much less time, much less involvement, and also much less access to all the details of how the company is doing, right? So what we say is what we showed is the private equity being more involved is able to understand better when the performance is due to the CEO and when the performance is due to the industry or just some bad luck, right? And therefore what we are trying to say is we should have a little bit of a review and understand better for the boards, what's the role of the board. If you want, you know, when we all talk about short-termists and investors, right, and the pressure on the CEO, part of it happens also through a board member. Because if the board members, you feel that you are subject to the pressure, right, you don't want to be seen covered in the newspaper as the friends of the CEO who didn't push. You don't want to have activist investors say you're not going to do your job. You might overreact. While the private equity, there's no pressure. They own the company. They do what they want. You can see they are much more slower. When the performance first dips, they'll wait time, see exactly what is happening, and accumulate enough information about the actual ability of the entrepreneur before taking an action. As a matter of fact, we found cases where, with private equity, the CEO was replaced after very good performance. And the argument, because we had minutes of meetings, in some cases we had very detailed information, was this person was perfect for the first phase. Now the company is on another phase. Not every CEO who is perfect for the first phase is the one perfect for the other phase. But you can imagine what means that you're on a public board, the company has been overperforming, and you decide that you're going to change the CEO. It's not easy, right? So the message we have been trying to put out is, and other people, some people looking at public company, we looking at private equity and comparing, is we need to step a little bit back, okay? One of the thoughts I had was everybody thinks that you can decide what the company should do by looking at the number, the public numbers, right? We look at the performance, we look at the numbers that are released, and we decide what the company should do as outside. But if it were like that, we wouldn't need a board, right? If you think about it, what is the role of the board? It's exactly to have 10 people who have access to information that will never be released, who can observe the CEO, how this person takes decision, or all the management, how they take decision, how they arrive at that, so that they can take better decision than just based on the numbers. But then we cannot judge whether the board is doing well or not on the numbers, because if we could assess their performance on the basis of the bad numbers, then let's not have a board, right? The whole point. And I think people have somehow lost a bit the concept of why we want the board. We want the board because we want some people we can trust to take decisions, even if from the numbers it doesn't necessarily back it up. Now, this is the end of my general things. I'm open to question on everything I discussed or anything else if you want. Yes.
We'll open it up to questions for Francesca, and I'll just repeat what you say just briefly for the recording, please.
So my question is about going back to the underwriter. So when a company goes to the underwriter, I've got two questions. One, how is the underwriter paid? And secondly, is the underwriter legally allowed to buy some of the stock when they, in fact, issue the IPO?
Yes.
So the question is about the underwriter. Is the underwriter, how are they paid, and are they allowed to buy some of the stock?
So the underwriter is paid on a fee, which is usually percentage of the revenues, okay? And that is been highly contentious. There have been investigation of the SECs, and there's someone in Florida who's been really the king of IPOs. The thing he's been showing for the last 30 years is that this fee is called the 3% solution is the same no matter what. And what some people find, so the you can see that the hint is there some collusion, right? Because you have a huge IPO, a small IPO is exactly the same percentage, right? This wouldn't be collusion where people talk, so it's very difficult to prove. So let's say that has been highly contentious, especially in the U.S. It is always the same percentage. Internationally, it depends. It could be much more, it could be much less, just because the markets are very different. But in the U.S., it's very much the same. I would have said historically came a bit down because the book building has a bit decreased some of the risk that you had in the following method, but they're all basically doing the same thing. And the other thing, can they buy shares? So that is actually very interesting because what the justification for that fee for the underwriter in part is advisor, the process and everything, but in part is for aftermarket support. So what it means is, well, they can actually check that if it goes badly, I recover or I can do things. So by law, now I'm talking about just the U.S., right? Because I don't know every country in the world exactly what they do, but given we are in the U.S., in the U.S., the underwriter can buy shares, but those shares will be flagged. So what it means is, in the record, there'll be a flag that says the underwriter is buying shares. Because the danger is, otherwise, shares start going down, I buy them all, so that... Exactly. And then people don't know, right? They think, oh, the price is fine. The price is not fine. There's someone who's buying them to keep it up. So if you do a trade like that, it will be flagged. However, there are ways to actually avoid that. And one is the green shoe option. The name is strange. It comes because the first company who did it was called Green Shoe. I don't know. Anyway, so something like that. So what typically you would do is you would go, almost any company does it when they go public, right? Suppose you are about to sell, you want to sell really 100,000 shares, okay? You will say, I will sell 100,000 shares plus the green shoe option, which means I keep the option, if the market goes well, to sell another 25%, 25,000, okay? So, but the way you do it is very different. You go and you sell immediately when you do the book building and allocate. You allocate 125,000. Then you look at what that market happens. If the market, the price starts going up, right, you're going to say, so suppose you sold at 10. Price starts going up, you announce to the market, it's been a success, and I've exercised my green shoe option, and I've sold another 25,000, okay? The market starts going down below 11, 8, 7. What you do is, as an underwriter, as an investment bank, you buy back those 25,000. Those are not flagged. You're just saying, I decided not to exercise my green shoe option. Technically, right? Technically, you are not buying back shares because it's almost like I never decided to sell them. And you're buying back maybe at 8. You sold them at 11. You're buying back at 8. So as an underwriter, you make a lot of money. And all you say at the end is, we've decided not to exercise our green shoe option. Okay? So that also has been, people have been arguing, saying, well, because of the green shoe option, you're paying a fee to the underwriter for all this stabilizing the market, but actually they make money because if it goes back, you buy back at a lower market, so you can actually do it.
So the question is about insider trading. How does book building not violate insider trading?
Because all I'm saying is it will be anything between 5 and 15. Just tell me how many you want, at what price. I'm not telling you what the price. At the end of those 20 days in which I got all the opinion, and people could change their mind, by the way, people over that time, it's more like the last week, it really what matters, right? I look at that. There is no insider trading because it's the investors is telling me, I'm the underwriter at the bank, the investors is telling me what he or she thinks is the price. I am not telling them what should be. I announce to everybody the price is between 5 and 15. That's announced to everybody. That's public information. People give me their opinion. And then I set the price based on that opinion. But it's them telling me what's the information, and then I aggregate it in the price so it's valuable for everybody, right? So they are not taking advantage of any information that they shouldn't have.
But is this offer made to everybody, like in the world, or just to a group of managers?
No, it's not only a group of managers, but what is usually cut out is an individual, right? If I want to go and I want to go a bid, unless there's a tranche just for an individual, you won't have that, okay? So there are some IPOs, especially if it's a privatization, that they'll say, we keep 20% for individual of the public who want to bid, okay? So it's basically open to everybody, but what they're trying to put a floor to people that they think have information. I don't want some mad person to come and say whatever crazy price, because then what do I do with that? So,
I'm so sorry to cut you off, but I want to get in one last question, and we do have one more speaker today. Please, Shirley.
Well, I think you did a remarkable job, not even understanding the demographic of our class. We all related to the issue regarding women, and I thank you. But the second was private equity. And just to let you know, there are people in this classroom who have had enormous insight into private equity because of their investments and participation in it and running funds. The question is, I understand, but just general knowledge, there's a tendency to go into heavier private equity and buy stock back because of the point that you made, which is rather than being subject to analysts telling the CEO, why don't you have two more cents in your earnings this year, this quarter, they are reliant upon a board who really studies their thinking process. I want A, your question, is there a tendency to have an increase of private ownership as opposed to public? And two, is it in effect because of that reason?
So the question is really about the increase of private ownership.
Yes. So indeed, and this is actually to me a problem in the sense, and then I will say why. So there is an increase in private ownership because private equity is taking private these companies using the Fed that they think they can run them better, so they can. It's advantageous for them to buy a company which is public and then run it as a private. There are companies who are private who, rather than trying to go public and have that problem, may look for private investors to enter. So if they need additional money, instead of going on the stock market, because that was the original reason, right? Why do you go on the stock market? Because if you need money for the next investment, you can raise money. Or as a founder, if you can want to, you know, get some liquidity and at least, you know, get at least partially out of your of what you've done for your life, you do it by going public. Now you can go to the private market without having that problem. The third reason is also that with the advent of investors like SoftBank or other venture capital who enter very late, or even fund managers, there's a lot of evidence that if you had a startup, a certain stage, you know, you keep growing, 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 at a certain stage, you have to be you go public. Now, no, at the stage in which you would have gone public before, you will get new money from venture capital, fund managers. So once again, you don't need that. So the evidence is the number of public companies is diminishing dramatically. But to me, it is a problem, right? It is a problem because, first of all, private equity is accessible to wealthier investors, right? Okay, we can do it through the pension funds, then can democratize it, but not everybody's in that pension fund. The stock market is a way, right, for an investor, a small saver, to take part in the growth of a country. So the more it goes public, we less have access, right? So we can justify, but that is one of the problems. The other problem is when we value a company, we usually always use the information from the stock market to get what is the rate of return, what should be the beta, what are the multiples, how to value that company. The least and least representative is the stock market. The less is useful to value a company correctly. So that is, you know, the trend is there because of this problem and because of there's more money that is willing to enter in private companies, but we should be careful because it's, you know, the stock market serves a purpose.
Wonderful. Please join me in thanking Francesco Cornell. Francesco will be here after Jan speaks, so as these questions continue, she will be here to answer them one-on-one. Obviously, it's a deep passion of yours. Thank you. I'm just going to briefly introduce Jan Eberle by pointing out one notation in her bio to you. Jan has been a real pleasure to work with through this process. She has a great sense of humor and seems to roll with things. And what I noticed in her bio that I'd like to call out to you is not the title that she had, but the title that she had in the U.S. Treasury was a title that had to be confirmed by the U.S. Senate. So I think anyone who's withstood Senate confirmation is somebody who knows how to roll with the process. And I thank you have been a pleasure to work with. So please join me in welcoming Jan. She did warn me there are quite a bit of charts in here, yeah. So she's going to really teach us something deep about the economy. Please join me in welcoming Jan.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Actually, I think I said deep and dark.
You did.
Because
I'm hiding that from you.
now. Yes, okay. I think they're going to figure it out. First, thanks very much for inviting me to join you and to speak. I want to first confirm everything Francesca said about women in finance. So we're roughly contemporaries in the finance academia. And when I first came to Kellogg, it was transformative for me because there were 5 women on the tenure track in the finance department, and this was not yesterday. This was a little while ago. And I had come from Wharton, where I was also a tenure track professor. It's a much larger department. And there were 2 women on the faculty, which was the most they'd ever had. And the funny thing was that the other woman, Karen Lewis, is 6 feet tall and blonde, and people would mix us up all the time. It was like there was a Karen Jan in the finance department, and it was sort of one interchangeable person. You only had to keep track of one. So coming to Kellogg was exciting for me. And at one point, after I came, we had 6 tenured women in the finance department at Kellogg, which was more than the entire number of tenured women in all the other departments combined. And since then, some of those women have moved to other departments, which is sad in some ways, but the other way to think of it is that we're seeding the rest of the profession. And Francesca correctly pointed out that it doesn't help to be a fantastic island in a difficult profession, because you're relying on other members of the profession for invitations to seminars, to write letters for tenure. So elevating the whole profession is quite important, and I think Kellogg's example, but also his leadership role, has been important in that. All right, so let me move to a darker subject here. I thought the weather this morning was actually quite appropriate. It was a dark and stormy morning, and we're going to talk about fiscal policy. The main issue, so that means debt and deficits, and it'll get worse from there, I promise. So I'm going to start with the current situation, which receives public notice. But the more important issues, I think, are the longer run issues. So we want to think about what the budget situation, and I'll talk only about the federal budget, means for the future in the economy and the obligations that we're taking on going forward. And I want to give us also some tools for thinking about the choices that have to be made. No one is surprised that in budgeting there are trade-offs to be made. There are difficult choices to be made. But there's been many advances in economics and in finance to help us analyze the benefits, the payoffs. That's what we do. And help us think about those trade-offs. So the light part of the discussion is in the tools that we have to think about making these choices. So they're hard choices, but we will face them. And the question is, what will we be armed with when we have to make those choices? And so there are some things we will have to help us. And I wanted to insert a little bit of monetary policy. I'll have to keep it very short because I've been doing more work recently on monetary policy and presented at the Fed's Jackson Hole conference. So women do get asked for keynote speeches. And these issues have been very much at the forefront in monetary policy as well. So it might be tempting to think that there's a solution that will come from the monetary side. I'm a little less optimistic about that. All right. So the current situation in the federal budget is depicted here. This shows the budget deficit over time, starting from 1969 to the current year, 2019, and then the 10 years of projections. And you see there was a brief period of surpluses in the late 1990s with the dot-com boom brought in a lot of revenue. The financial crisis, the budget deficit, went to 10% of GDP. This is all, most of the data I'll show you is as a percent of GDP, because the numbers are kind of overwhelming. You know, right now the budget deficit is sitting around 4% of GDP. That's about $1 trillion. So that was the big headline number that came out. So it's sometimes hard to keep track of. Trillion is a big number, okay, by any measure. But to compare it to the past, it helps to look at shares of GDP. And the change we saw coming into this year, so this rise in the deficit, was incorporating two big pieces of legislation. So the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the TCJA, which was passed in 2017. And then there's less attention paid. There was a spending compromise passed in 2018, which lifted spending caps on both defense and non-defense spending. And so that added to the deficit as well. So those two things increased the budget deficit over this period from 2018 forward to 2029. So it ends up basically where it would have been in 2029, but what these two pieces of legislation did was essentially fill in the gap so we get there quicker. Okay, so this area here is due to these two pieces of legislation. But you look historically, and budget deficits are not a new thing. On average, budget deficits in the U.S. Have been almost 3% of GDP for this entire period on average. And nonetheless, the national debt has not exploded, even though we've consistently run these deficits, because what's happened is that the economy has grown faster than the debt has accumulated. So that's always the tension in these budget calculations, is how much debt is accumulating and how high is the interest that we're paying on it, which will be a theme I return to, compared to the growth in the economy. So up till now, the budget deficit has been 2.9% on average, but the economy has grown that fast or faster. Okay, so it hasn't exploded. And again, budget deficits are not unusual. Okay, so but what is unusual here is the timing of the budget deficit. So I'm going to put up two lines. This is the same budget deficit line that you just saw on the previous graph. So here's the budget surplus in the late 1990s. Here's the financial crisis. And here we are now with a budget deficit that's around 4% of GDP. Okay, so that's data we know already. I want to compare that to the business cycle. And the next line I'm going to put up, I want to explain it because it'll look a little different than what you usually see. This is the unemployment rate, but I'm going to invert the scale so that a high unemployment rate is going to appear down here. Okay? So this is the unemployment rate on this axis. And the reason I'm inverting it is so you can think of it as a measure of the health of the labor market. So when you see a number up here, unemployment is low, the labor market is strong. So the red line is the unemployment rate in this inverted scale. So you see the financial crisis, for example, the unemployment rate was almost 10%, a very unhealthy labor market. In the recovery from the crisis, the unemployment rate has fallen and the labor market has strengthened. Now, it's unavoidable looking at the history. You can do an ocular correlation there and see that these are very highly correlated. Typically, the budget deficit goes up when the economy is weak because tax revenue goes down and spending obligations like unemployment benefits rise. There might also be a fiscal stimulus, and so then the budget deficit tends to rise when the labor market is weak, and then when the labor market is recovering, revenue recovers as well, and the two move together. So what's unusual about the current budget deficit, this increase in the budget deficit, is it's running against the business cycle. So it's against the business cycle in the sense that the unemployment rate is quite low, 3.7%, so it's low compared to most measures of a full employment economy. Inflation is very low. These are things that most economists would be quite happy about, but we're never happy, just so you know. We're never truly happy. But the budget deficit has risen during this time. So that what's unusual about the current budget deficit or the current budget situation is that there's this rise in the deficit when the economy is strong. So that's what's unusual. Now, what's helpful for thinking about this is the fact that we have a strong economy now takes a lot of the usual fiscal issues off the table. Because usually when the budget deficit is high, you're thinking, well, the economy is weak, and so the budget deficit will shrink when the economy strengthens again. But that's clearly not happening now. That's not the issue now. So we can set aside all of the cyclical questions and all of those explanations and just think about the budget deficit and what it means for the long run, because it's not a cyclical phenomenon at the moment. Okay, it's a phenomenon of budget choices, and so we can think more about the long run. All right, unfortunately, the long run isn't very reassuring. This is data from the Congressional Budget Office, and let me say a bit about where the data come from, because it's quite important, and I'll use a lot of their data. So the Congressional Budget Office, or the CBO, is the nonpartisan group in Congress that analyzes any budget proposal. So any member of Congress can ask for a proposal to be scored, that's what it's called, for the budget. And the CBO is required to give an estimate of how much it will cost in terms of eventual revenue over a 10-year period. And if it's a tax proposal, then they, together with the tax office in Congress, will provide an estimate of how much it will change revenue. Okay? But they do that, and this is what's most important going forward, is they do that under current law. So they have very specific requirements for how they do that. So they're not forecasting changes in the law. They're only forecasting how the existing law will change revenues or expenditures as time plays out going forward. So what may change is the economy, what may change is demographics, foreshadowing what we're going to see. So they're looking at how the revenue and spending is expected to change under current law. So that's what we're seeing here. So what we saw before was the difference between these two lines, the budget deficit, and this breaks it out into revenue on the bottom, because revenue is lower than expenditures, and the gap between the two is the budget deficit. So going forward, that deficit is rising, not because revenues are shrinking. Revenues are actually growing, but outlays are growing faster. Okay? And I want to pull apart each of those so we see what's driving this rising budget deficit over time. I think most people find it surprising that revenues are actually expected to grow. So where does it come from? The scale in the previous slide sort of hides that there's a 3 percentage point increase in revenues as a share of GDP over this 30-year period. So it's a fairly substantial increase in revenues. So where does it come from? So the biggest immediate increase in revenue comes from expiration of some provisions of the TCJA, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So starting in 2025 and through 2027, the personal tax cuts, the personal tax provisions of the TCJA expire. So there were two main tax provisions. One was the corporate tax. That's permanent. The other was the permanent, was the personal tax, the income tax brackets were all lowered. Well, those are scheduled to go back. Okay, this is how they managed to keep the revenue implications of the tax bill sort of within the requirements of the appropriations. So that raises about 1% of GDP in revenue. Okay, this big gap, the darker green gap on the top, is called the tax on high premium health insurance. So the government agencies tend to have long ways of describing things that get described more simply in the world. So this is the Cadillac tax. Okay, so the Cadillac tax is the tax on expensive health plans. And that's been in the law for almost 10 years. And it keeps getting postponed. Okay? But under current law, it comes back. And it raises maybe 0.5% of GDP if it comes back under current law. Okay? And then the other source of revenue under current law is called real bracket creep. Okay. Now that sounds like something we can understand, creep. Yeah, all right, we understand creep. Real bracket creep means the tax brackets creep up, okay, but more slowly than income does. So one of the least heralded aspects of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was its biggest revenue raiser, which is they used a different price index to index tax brackets. Okay, who could possibly care, right? It's changing the price index. It just seems incredibly technical. It can't matter. It matters a lot. And it matters more and more over time. What they did was use a price index that goes up more slowly. So they use a chain-weighted price index. I could talk about it in detail if you would like. But the chain-weighted price index goes up more slowly, and so what it means is when your income goes up quickly, you move into a higher tax bracket sooner than you otherwise would have. And when you move into a higher tax bracket, you pay more taxes, and it raises revenue. So that seemingly innocuous change in the price index raises, you know, a point by the end of 30 years, but more and more over time. This just continues to go up. Okay. So that's where the revenue comes from. This seems pretty well baked into the law at this point. These other provisions, you know, the Cadillac tax has been postponed before. Most people expect it might get postponed again, so we'll see whether these other revenue provisions actually come to fruition. But under current law, that's where the additional revenue comes from, and that keeps the budget deficit lower. So we might not, you may like these or not like them, but they keep the budget deficit lower. Okay, so over time, so this is the 2018 spending and revenue compared to 30 years later, 2048, and you can see where the gaps are coming from. So first, net interest payments are going to rise quite a lot. The other major expenditure increases are in health and social security programs. I'm going to show you these over time. Everything else shrinks. So the budget, if you look at all the pieces of it, is a very complicated thing. But that complicated object really boils down to a few things. So the increases in expenditures are from interest costs and from health expenditures. Okay, health and aging. Okay, everything else shrinks. Okay, and as a result, the budget deficit rises. Okay. So the health and interests are driving this rising cost, and you can see it. The two things that are upward sloping over time are the major health programs and the net interest costs. You might have thought Social Security played a bigger role. You see Social Security rising for about the next 10 years, but then the baby boomers will have mostly retired. And so the Social Security doesn't shrink again, but it flattens out. So the effect of the baby boomers is seen here. In the major health programs, it's interesting to think, what's driving that? So let me show you. So here's the composition of the health programs that I showed you in the previous slide. People often think it's the ACA, it's Medicaid. Those rise, but they're fairly flat. The big increase, 3/4 of the increase is from Medicare. Okay. And similar to Social Security, the initial increase is mostly driven by the retirement of the baby boomer. So demographics play a huge role in the budget. I tell my students when we talk about these macro issues that by the end of the year, any question that I ask, if they respond with demographics, they're probably right. Because demographics drive some of the most important long-run trends that we see in the U.S., but also around the world. So it's worth noting that the U.S. is certainly not the only and not even the most extreme case of demographics affecting economics around the world. So this is data from the UN. The U.S. is over here, this blue bubble, and we're looking at countries by their income per capita. So these are the advanced, wealthier economies. And the vertical axis shows the change in the percent of their population over age 60. So the advanced economies, so the U.S., you're seeing about a 30% increase in the share of the population over 60. And that's a big demographic shift. But when you put it on this scale, and Japan, people thought of Japan as a rapidly aging economy. The aging has already happened there. Basically, they started the process earlier, so they have a large share of their population over 60, but it's not rising as much as it was. The big increases are in developing economies. And because in those economies, what the big trends over time have been rising incomes and hence rising lifespans, together with a lowering birth rate. So the working age population is growing, but not as quickly as the share of the population that's over 60. So they will be confronting all of these same issues, which affect not only social services, and that's what many of the advanced economies are confronting, is the effect on pensions, the effect on healthcare, the effect on social services, but also an effect on productivity. So the data, so don't tell the millennials this, but actually older workers have a positive effect on productivity. And so the retirement of older workers puts downward pressure on national productivity. So those experienced workers, they know things. It turns out. It turns out. All right. So let's take this back to the budget. Okay, in the federal budget, the biggest programs that we just saw are in this mandatory spending bucket. So this is another example of language that is used in federal programs that doesn't correspond with use of English language anywhere else. So they have these things called mandatory spending and discretionary spending. Mandatory is not mandatory, and discretionary is not discretionary. The mandatory programs, the spending is determined by a law, like the Social Security program is a mandatory program. There's not a budget for Social Security every year. There's a law that says what benefits people are entitled to and at what age they're entitled to draw them. And then when people apply for Social Security and start to receive Social Security benefits, that determines the cost of Social Security for that year. So that's a mandatory program because the spending doesn't go through a budgeting process. It's determined by the law. Okay, so that's, and most of the spending that you see here, 61%, is mandatory spending. So when Congress says, no, we want to really get serious, we want to pull things back in, they can't touch 61% of the budget unless they go back and change the Social Security law or they change the Medicare law. Okay. And you've heard the term the third rail, right? Those programs are called the third rail of American politics because touch them and you die. right? So that's the political description of mandatory programs, because they're in the law for a reason, right? They're highly valued programs. So changing them is very difficult. The discretionary programs, these do go through the budget process. And I'll just mention one part of this, which is investment. Any investment that the government makes is in the discretionary part of their program. And about 12% of the federal budget is investment, which is capital. About half of it is infrastructure, so mostly roads, so the infrastructure program. And then the other half is split roughly evenly between R&D and education. Now, I pull these out because they're treated as expenses in the budget. But if you were doing budgeting for a company, this would be in your capital budget, right? And you would treat it differently. But in the federal government has a cash budget, and these are treated purely as expenses. I want to come back to those because we generally think that investments pay off down the road. And there is evidence that these kind of investments do pay off down the road. So as we think about what to do about the budget deficit, we want to keep in mind that these expenditures are not just cash out the door. Okay. Federal investment, just to keep in mind, has been growing in real terms over time. So it's kept pace with inflation. But it has not kept pace with the growth in the economy. So as a share of GDP, for the last budget year, it was 2.5% of GDP, which is the lowest on record. So you can see what part of the budget is getting squeezed. There's been a shift toward, I want to skip over that for now. The general picture of the budget is, there's been persistent deficits. They're tending to rise over time. There's been a shift in spending toward health. Even in the R&D component, more R&D spending is on health than other forms of technology. So there's been a shift toward seniors and a shift toward health over time. Okay. Let me turn to the interest component. Okay. So economists make an important distinction between the primary deficit and the total deficit. Everything I've shown you up to now is just the total budget deficit, and which includes the interest expense. Okay. The primary deficit is the deficit before you pay interest. So think of that as like your operating deficit. And notice that that's not actually growing that much. Okay. And this observation has created a kerfuffle in the economics field, because several people have pointed out that, well, what really matters for whether deficits are sustainable, it's like deficits, it sounds bad, but how big is too big? Okay, so too big we've generally thought of as a deficit that grows over time. That's not sustainable. Okay? And with the interest costs growing like this, that looks not sustainable. But if you actually look at interest costs, and most people in finance are pretty aware of this, interest costs, especially for the U.S. Treasury, are very low. Right? And so what you want to compare is the growth in the economy to the cost of financing the debt. And if the economy is growing faster, as we saw historically, than the interest on the debt, then essentially the economy grows its way out. Okay? So what we're seeing here is teetering on the brink, right? So the growth of GDP is 2.5%, right? What's the interest rate on 30-year bonds right now, 30-year Treasury bonds? 2.5%, right? So it's also very low. So some people have pointed out that in this race between the interest rate and the growth rate of the economy, it's a close call. Okay? And so maybe if the interest rate remains low, there's less reason to worry about this. Okay, so this was first pointed out, so with full disclosure from my PhD advisor at MIT, who was then the chief economist at the IMF. Now, the reason this created a kerfuffle is, you know what the IMF does. They go into economies that are having trouble and they tell them you need to cut your budget deficit. So having the chief economist from the IMF say, well, maybe you don't have to worry about this quite so much, was quite a shock to many of the staff members at the IMF who said, you know, it's like having the Pope, and then they stop because they can't even imagine, you know, that anybody would could talk about not worrying about budget deficits. So that's the argument that's happening. Most people are, I think, on the side of worrying about budget deficits because they're not convinced that these low interest rates will last. And we can talk more about asymmetric costs, but the cost of getting it wrong could be quite high. So that's the concern. Okay. So the debt, this is part of the argument about why not to worry about the debt. Here, this is the total debt, not the deficit, so the accumulated debt as a share of GDP. I'll just look at the red line, which is publicly held. And you see that even though the deficit is still high, it's flattening out, right? And that's part of the argument, that maybe we don't have to worry so much because the economy is growing quickly enough to be able to support this level of deficits. So that's the back and forth and the push and pull. All right. So netting out. Rising deficits and debt. Investment is about 12% of the budget, but a falling share of GDP. Rising share, a rising focus in the budget on seniors and healthcare. So there's difficult decisions to be made ahead. Let me give you one example of where it could be very easy to get it wrong. To make a misinformed decision if you didn't look carefully at the data. And I chose this one because it's about education. And it's something that's important to all of us and near and dear to my heart. This is an example of a program that was put in place in the state of Florida where they provided tuition financing for students to go to Florida International University. Okay? And what we want to look at is how much it costs the state to implement this program. So if you just looked at the initial budget cost, you would say it costs just over $11,000 per student, and that paid a year of tuition. Okay, so that would be the cost to the state. That's what would go into their budget. But is that really the cost, even to the state? Not really, because the student also paid some tuition. So the student paid about $3,000 in tuition, so that reduced the net cost to the state. The students were mostly coming from community colleges. Okay? So instead of going to community college, they went to a four-year Florida International University. So that saved the state $5,600 in community college expenditures when the student moved to the four-year school. Now, but the students stayed in school longer. So they went for 4 years instead of two. So the state lost some tax revenue. Because you see how detailed we're going to get here. So the state lost some tax revenue because the students were in school longer, and that was about $2,000 based on the earnings they would have received at that point. Okay. But then when they graduate from Florida International University, they earn a higher income than they would have if they had gone to community college. And the state earns tax revenue on that, which is an additional $7,000. Okay? So this is over 15 years. They literally followed people and got the information from them until they were age 33. So this is a good study. They follow the people. And so what did it cost the state of Florida over 15 years for this program? It was a net benefit of $3,000. Okay? So the cost was negative, even just from the narrow point of view of the state. When you then look at the benefit to the student, right? These private costs were the $3,000. They had lower initial earnings because they were in school longer. Then they had these higher earnings on which the state earned taxes. And then they projected over the rest of their working life how much these students would earn. And they end up with a net benefit of over $100,000. Okay? So these are the kind of things that budgets don't capture. And you would look at this and say the state paid $11,000. Actually, when you take a dynamic view, the state gained $3,000, and the rate of return to the student was $100,000, right? So it's hard to calculate a rate because the cost is negative, right? So the rate of return is actually infinite. The study that looked at this has looked at many other programs, and they tend to find each dot here is a program. They tend to find that these programs that benefit the young have very high rates of return, and which makes sense because the payoff periods are very long. So when you help someone when they're young, their incomes are higher for a longer period of time. Now, that isn't to say there's lots of other programs that don't have these pecuniary benefits that are valuable for other reasons. Think about the programs we have for veterans, right? We don't have those programs for pecuniary benefits. We have them because there's a social contract between civilians and the military, between the young and the old. We have lots of social contracts. So this is only one angle. But I find this one useful for thinking about the payoff to what looks like just expenses. The last thing, and I'll just mention this briefly for time purposes, is can monetary policy help us here? Because monetary policy helps keep interest rates low. Interest rates are important for fiscal policy. And in many aspects of macro policy, we've relied more and more on the Fed to give a push to the economy, to be agile, and to move quickly. So let's look at what the Fed can do. So thinking about where we are in Fed policy, there's been a lot of discussion about whether the Fed should lower rates or raise rates or where we are in the business cycle. The actual Fed funds rate, so that's the short-term rate, which is the Fed's main policy tool, is here in green, in blue. You see it was near zero for the financial crisis and long thereafter. The green line is an estimate of what a Taylor rule, which is one of the main sort of benchmarks for monetary policy that John Taylor came up with and the Fed uses as a sort of rule of thumb. So it's a function of the unemployment rate and inflation. And you see that what the Taylor rule would have suggested would that the Fed funds rate should have been deeply negative during the financial crisis. So that's not a sign that the Fed should have had deeply negative interest rates, but a sign of how severe their crisis was and how much the traditional tools of monetary policy would have said that, you know, the Fed should be extremely expansionary during this period. Okay. But once we get past the crisis, so you get into 2014, 2015, the Fed lifted off here, and what traditional rules of monetary policy would have said is that they should have lifted off very quickly. Okay. Because what you saw was very low rates of inflation and unemployment falling, so the labor market getting stronger. Now, the reason, why didn't the Fed do that? Why didn't they follow their traditional rule? Because historically, they followed it pretty closely, and they really deviated here. And the big difference between the traditional rule and what the Fed has actually done is the effect of unemployment. Because right now, unemployment is very low, and the traditional rule says, well, when unemployment is low, the economy is strong, the Fed should raise rates. Okay? The Fed has taken sort of an asymmetric view of unemployment, that when unemployment is high, They want to lower rates. They're very aggressive about doing that. But when unemployment is low, they don't view that as a problem they need to fix, okay? Especially when they're not seeing inflation, right? So if the Fed saw low unemployment and high inflation, then they might be much more worried. But what they're seeing is both low unemployment and low inflation, so there's less pressure to raise interest rates and try to tamp down the economy. Because what's the problem with low unemployment? That seems like a good thing in the economy as long as you're not seeing inflation, right? So they've taken an asymmetric view of unemployment in this period. So when they talk about their rule of thumb or their rule for interest rates in this period, their rhetoric, their discussion about unemployment is quite different. It's taken a real asymmetric rule. What we've seen in short rates, though, with the recent uptick in rates, so after the liftoff, there's really not much room for the Fed to maneuver, right? So when you take this in historical perspective, even when the Fed wants to lower rates, by historic standards, rates are already extremely low. And so one concern about raising or lowering rates at this point is that there's not much headroom, right? That the Fed doesn't have much room to lower rates. That's short rates. This doesn't help the federal budget, right? Because there's no borrowing and business borrowing by the same token at the overnight Fed funds rate, right? The rate you're more interested in is long rates. And when I said that rates had come down, here, this is the recent decline in long rates. And so long, this is the 10-year treasury. Long rates are already extremely low. So there's not much room for the Fed to swoop in and try to have a significant impact on the economy when the 10-year treasury is around 2% already. Okay, so fiscal policy, it's not so much deep and dark. There's a lot happening. It's a very complex situation, but if you're forward-looking, then what you see is a long series of deficits in the future. We've had deficits in the past, so that alone should not set off alarm bells, but they're rising deficits over time. And the budget is already skewed toward mandatory programs, which are hard to control because they're set in law. And they're also skewed toward health and toward seniors. And if you're worried about productivity, you might want to think about how much we're investing in things like education, R&D, infrastructure, which are not part of these mandatory programs. And monetary policy will not swoop in and save us on this. Monetary policy is highly constrained because interest rates, not only the short rate, but the long rate, are already quite low. So I would be happy to take any questions that you have about fiscal, or if you'd like to go a little further into monetary policy, we can do that. Any questions? It was so depressing. Yes.
So the question is about the FIU study. Is it the only state study on these effects?
Yeah, no, there's many more. Each one of those dots in the second chart represented a study that was included in this compilation, but there's many studies of individual education programs. So they're trying to get the micro data on individual students so that the best studies follow people over time so you can see the effect of education on them over time. And sometimes the results are very surprising. So one that I saw recently looked at the effects of free community college. Okay. So free community college has many positive effects for the students who go, but in the unexpected consequences category, it actually reduced college graduation rates. You might say, how can that? Yeah, that was my reaction, right? Furrowed brow, how could that happen? It's because free community college induced some students who would have gone to a four-year school to go to community college because it was so much less expensive. And they would have had a higher chance of graduating from college if they'd stayed at a four-year school. So sometimes the results are not what you expect. Yeah. But there's many studies on it. Yes?
This may open another can of worms, but what's your thought on the whole yield curve and the recessionary discussions, et cetera? The fact that it's been certainly a topic of conversation over the last 12 months.
So the question is really about the recession and sort of the talk about an impending recession. Did I hear that properly? And the yield curve.
Oh, and the yield curve. So the as you saw actually in my interest rate graphs, the reduction in the long-term interest rate means that in some cases, long-term interest rates are actually below the shorter-term interest rates, which is an inverted yield curve and has been associated with recessions in the past. And it's not a perfect correlation by any means. And I think the big question to ask is why did long-term rates decline? Right? So is it because market participants were thinking, well, the economy is going to slow down, and then the Fed will intervene, and there'll be more downward pressure on long rates? Or is it something else? Right? It's always hard to parse that out. There's lots of something else items in the economy now. So trade policy and uncertainty is probably having a negative effect on the economy. There's concerns about fiscal policy. So what will fiscal policy be going forward? So those could also have a negative effect on expectations and tend to lower rates. The fact that the Fed acted probably calmed some of the recession fears because the Fed intervened pretty quickly and then intervened again. Right? So it did seem like there was a recovery of expectations, especially after the second Fed intervention, because the Fed not only said, but then also acted in a way that said, that conveyed that they were ready to support the expansion. And Jay Powell used almost exactly those words, ready to support the expansion. They called it an insurance cut, which was a new term in thinking about how the Fed acted. So to the extent that there were concerns before, I think they've been assuaged a bit. But these underlying risks in the economy are still there. The Fed doesn't change those, right? No, no. Yes.
Hi.
Oh, go ahead.
So the question is really about technology and entrepreneurial issues related to how the Fed might respond.
Right. I think the first step in answering that question is to understand how technological change has affected the growth rate in the economy. This is an enduring puzzle because you look around This is something I've worked on a little bit. This is part of what I talked about at Jackson Hole. You look around and you see so much change and so much innovation in the economy. You carry around this hugely powerful computer in your bag or in your pocket. I mean, it's hard to imagine that the world hasn't changed. But then you look at the productivity numbers and it's weak, it's flat, there's nothing happening. It's, I don't know, for economists, it's a question for our age. The main explanations, one is optimistic, one is pessimistic. The pessimistic one says that these technologies are transformative for our lives, but they're not creating productivity. They're not producing more output. They don't stack up to the jet age and penicillin, right? So they're not world-changing in the way that historic technological change was. So that's the pessimistic point of view, most persuasively argued by Bob Gordon in the economics department at Northwestern. And the counter-argument, the optimistic version, is that they just haven't had enough time to be implemented in a way that you see the productivity outcome. You think about this happened with personal computers. So the initial uses of personal computers, I saw this as a graduate student, right? You saw these great, powerful computers, and people got really good at Tetris. It was amazing. And then they could do word processing. But now we're actually seeing, AI as a result. So we're seeing applications now that we couldn't have even imagined, 20 years ago. So maybe the same will happen for the web. So that's the optimistic view. That one says just be patient. We don't know. We have to be patient to find out.
I'm sorry, Shirley?
Yes. It's already having an effect. If you compare, the sharpest comparison is Western Europe versus the rising Asian economies. The U.S. is in the middle because the Western European economies provide much more generous pension and health benefits. So they have the same demographics, if not worse, than the U.S., because the U.S. had higher immigration, so we're a bit younger. We're younger in so many ways, but younger demographically. But they have very generous benefits. In Asia, the social service benefits have been less generous, and the counterpoint to that is a very high savings rate. Right? So it's higher personal savings for retirement, and also more self-insurance. So when the benefits are not publicly provided, there's more self-insurance. If people have savings, they can cushion some of those shocks, to health and to retirement themselves. But self-insurance tends to be less generous and less effective than publicly provided benefits. I think the biggest example of this is Singapore, which is a very advanced economy in many ways. It has the world's highest savings rate. The savings rate in Singapore is 50% of GDP. But there's a big payroll tax, right, that then goes into savings that's provided for employees. So it's a very different model of retirement and social insurance.
Well, so you can work on your productivity. We are going to end on time. One, I want to remind you there is no class next week. So please, for your friends who are not here, make sure you tell them that there is no class next week. But I also just want to say thank you to have such two intelligent women with such deep expertise explore with such passion complex topics. It's incredible. Thank you both. Thank you. They'll both be here to answer questions. I know we missed you in the back twice. I apologize. They'll be here to answer questions. Thank you.
Great job. They really enjoyed it. That was great.
That was really fun. I've never seen